Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI returns to the Vatican, expressing his gratitude for the 3 days spent in Benin in joy and friendship. South African Cardinal Wilfred Napier looks ahead to the implementation of the apostolic exhortation Africemunus in his region. A political analyst and advisor to the Southern Africans Bishops' Conference shares his view of the main political figures in South Africa as the nation paves the way for new elections. Pope Benedict XVI has ended his 22nd apostolic visit abroad, which took him to the West African nation of Benin. Speaking before boarding a flight back to the Vatican, Benedict said that Africa was a continent for which he has a special regard and affection. Our correspondent in Benin, Father Moses Hamungole, reports.
Le voyage apostolique en terre africaine s'achève. Je suis reconnaissant envers Dieu. Quelques jours passés avec vous dans la joie et la cordialité.
My apostolic journey to Africa has come to an end. I thank God for these days spent among you in joy and friendship. Traditional and religious music, vigorous dance, which welcomed Benedict XVI on his arrival on 18th November, accompanied his departure from Cardinal Bernardin Gantin International Airport on board Alitalia plane. This apostolic visit was memorable and historic for a number of reasons, among them the signing and presentation of the apostolic exhortation Africemunus, which Benedict personally presented to the presidents of the regional and national bishops' conferences of Africa and nearby islands.
I hope that this exhortation will guide you in the proclamation of the good news of Jesus in Africa. It is not just a message or a word. It is above all openness and adhesion to a person, Jesus Christ's incarnate word.
Having personally participated and moved around the people at St. Rita Parish and at the airport, the sense of celebration that accompanied these functions was clearly a testimony of how much the people love and appreciate the Pope. People lined up on the streets to salute him, wave at him, sing and dance for him, and in celebration for his felt and appreciated presence among them. The presence of Muslims and other non-Christians was a remarkable and a visible sign of the interreligious communion between Catholics and non-Catholics in Benin. As Father Rombadi expressed before departure for Rome, the apostolic visit to Benin has been a success.
I think that this visit was really a big success from the pastoral and the spiritual point of view. The people has received the Pope with a very great enthusiasm, and for us it is important that the authorities receive well the Pope, but it's more important that the people are happy with the Pope, and I think the Pope was very impressed by this way of many people on the street around him, and all were very happy, all were singing, dancing, smiling. And this is an African way to receive, as the Pope has said, yes. And was very spontaneous. And I think that this demonstrates that the people understand that the Pope loves them, that the Catholic Church loves them, all, not only the Catholic, not only the Christian, but all.
Benedict communicated his interest in Africa, challenged Africa to take responsibility of its development, use her rich natural resources for the good of our people and future generations. Indeed, Africa is a place of hope. Despite the challenges her people face, they must remain hopeful and take into their hands the responsibility to realize a new Africa inspired by the desire to live in reconciliation, justice, and peace. Africa should no longer look up to anyone, but within herself and her children, in order to build a continent ready to partner with others and contribute to building a just and peaceful world. Benedict has left Africa, but his message through the apostolic exhortation Africae Munus and his personal presence on the African soil remain the lasting legacy of his love for Africa and the church in Africa. Men will remember his visit for years to come. At the end of the Second African Synod, Benedict called on Africa to rise up. Indeed, with the guiding principles to the evangelization of Africa through reconciliation, justice, and peace, Africa must now rise up and walk. Father Moses Hamungole, winding up after the departure of Benedict XVI from Cotonou, Benin.
Amongst those present to participate in papal events in Benin was Cardinal Wilfred Fox Napier, Archbishop of Durban in South Africa. Cardinal Napier is also one of the members of the Special Council for Africa, which came after the 2009 Second Synod for Africa, the first having taken place in 1994. Napier was also deeply involved in the synod itself, in the deliberations that led up to it, and in the whole process that followed it. He describes his thoughts and his feelings as he witnessed the signing of the apostolic exhortation, Africae Munus.
First of all, I think the thing that struck me most was how, in one way, a short time, so much has happened. We had that preparation for the synod. It seemed to take a long time before between the one synod and the next, but that was quite deliberate because we needed time to see how far we had implemented the first part of our program, our vision for Africa, if you could say the synod is about a vision for Africa. And when one thinks that the reason for delaying the second session was precisely to give bishops an opportunity to implement what could be implemented, to see what could not be done so easily, and to look at that for the next synod. So the very fact that the choice of subjects, reconciliation, justice, and peace, were taken out of quite a multitude of other subjects that were suggested by the headings of the chapters of the previous of Ecclesia in Africa in the previous synod, where justice and peace was selected as the area where Africa needed the most intervention. Well, when the Pope was signing there, I was just thinking, gosh, here we are moving now to reconciliation, justice, and peace. We mustn't forget the others, evangelization, but it's our way of evangelization, looking at these three topics in particular.
He points out that the document contains precious principles and guidelines for the church in Southern Africa.
I think, if anything, we are in South Africa at present in our Bishops' Conference, I should say Southern Africa because it includes Swaziland, Botswana. We are actually involved in a process of evangelization. How do we evangelize ourselves rather than simply catechized into knowing something about the faith? How do we actually live that faith and pass it on to others? So I think reconciliation, justice, and peace are a new challenge from the perspective that while we're talking about evangelization, this friendship, this relationship with Christ, we mustn't forget that Christ is in these brothers and sisters that need our intervention as far as justice, peace, and reconciliation in particular are necessary. And I would say in South Africa at the moment, we're going through a period where the governing party, which had a very high ideal and a high vision under Mandela and even under Thabo Mbeki, has now got to the point where I think it's lost touch completely with the vision, and the people in government are looking after themselves and not worrying about the people. So I think the message that will come out of this document will be very relevant to South Africa. It'll give us as bishops something to put on the table and say, Mr. President Jacob Zuma, this is what the church is saying we need to do in South Africa.
And how relevant is this document to politicians as it raises issues such as good governance and human rights?
You see, just recently there have been a lot of people saying the voice of the church is silent. We who were quite vocal during the time of apartheid have seemingly lost our voice. It's true and it's not true at the same time. On the one hand, what is true is that after 1994, we believed that the people who had fought for liberation, who had enunciated all those principles, South Africa according to the Freedom Charter, which was the basic document that I believe Nelson Mandela and his fellow leaders in the ANC had in mind, Buthelezi in the IFP, and all the other different sectors of the liberation movement, they all had those principles in mind, that South Africa was going to become a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic country in which everybody would have a place. We've seen that slowly being whittled away, eroded away, that vision, so that now it's a case of disadvantaged communities, black empowerment, this, that, and the other. So people are being excluded once again on the basis of race and color and culture. And this for us is a very sad thing because we had put our trust in these leaders that they would stick to the principles, the high principles that Oliver Tambo, Mandela, and so on had spoken to us about when we were involved in the liberation struggle with them. And to see now that same organization abandoning those principles and almost putting apartheid in reverse. So I think this document is going to give us the grounds upon which to hold a dialogue with the government. And I think it's going to help us to find our voice as well.
And what about role models in Africa? Are there currently any political leaders in Africa that can be looked up to as people we can proudly say they are good Catholic or Christian leaders?
I think by and large one would say it would be very difficult to find any leader in Africa who stands out simply as being a Christian and following Christian principles, let alone a Catholic who's following the Catholic social teaching as well. I think you'd battle to find them. You'd probably find them in lower positions because at the moment, I would say in Africa, the priority concern is power. And that's all people are interested in. And if riches give you power, they want the riches so they can maintain the power. And that's the kind of play we're seeing in South Africa. In a way, I think the document that was issued recently on economics is another one that we need to really study. We haven't done that yet. We really need to get our hands on it, study it, and relate it to the Munus Africae, I think it's called, the new document. When we get that there, then we'll be able to have a right hand and a left hand with which to engage with our politicians.
Now the journey is over, the document is signed, and a copy of it is in your hands. What happens next? How will implementation of this document even begin to take place?
Well, I suppose, first of all, we've all got to get copies of the document. It will have to come onto the agenda of one of our bishops' conference meetings. So far, I don't think there's any provision, certainly not for the January one. There's no provision made for that there, because we anticipate that it'll be some time before everybody's got the document in their hands. Then it'll most probably be put into the hands of the Justice and Peace Commission or Department of our conference for them to study it and to come up with recommendations of what actions can be taken as a result of the document. I would see that probably the process that would be followed would be that our president, Archbishop Buti, who's here and is going to be receiving the document, is very forthright. He's going to study that thing upside down and back to front. He's going to look at it from every angle. And I'm sure he's going to make it the subject of his president's report, his president's vision of what the conference should be engaging in. And I'm in that there, I would imagine he will be laying out some ideas of how we can relate what the document is saying to what we already made our plan of action for the future. I don't think there's any contradiction in it. If you've got evangelization, personal relationship with Christ, evangelizing society, evangelizing your parish so that through the parish the church can evangelize society. I think when you've got those as your dreams, your objectives, you're already on the way towards something more practical like reconciliation, justice and peace. So probably we would also need to make sure that our diocesan justice and peace commissions get hold of the document and study it and come up with the recommendations of what can be done in order to implement those aspects of it that fall to the diocese. If I remember correctly, the propositions upon this document, upon which this document is based, had some very explicit things to say to government at different levels. And I would see that where we have failed, perhaps up to now, to take the actions that even the message to the church in Africa had specified as things that we could be doing, where we have omitted them or have only done them incompletely, this document will reinforce us into, I'd say, taking another look at it and taking steps to implement it as well.
Vimbo, vimbo mfana.
Wena bamba vimbo,
vimbo
na minzo vimbo.
Vimbo mfana.
Wena bamba vimbo,
vimbo
na minzo vimbo.
Cardinal Napier's words are the perfect introduction to my next interview. As I'm sure you know, Southern Africa has a special place in my heart, and I have been following with interest recent political developments there. You may have heard that some 10 days ago, the South African ANC Youth League president, Julius Malema, was suspended for 5 years for disciplinary reasons. He was found guilty of sowing divisions and bringing the ruling ANC party into disrepute by insulting President Jacob Zuma and calling for Botswana's democratically elected president to be overthrown. I asked Mike Pothier, research coordinator of the Parliamentary Office of the Southern Africans Bishops' Conference, whether he agrees the suspension of Malema should help pave the way for Zuma to secure a second term as ANC leader, and hence as the country's president, at a party conference in a year's time.
Yes, definitely. I think that Zuma's position is very much strengthened. I don't think that he's guaranteed yet that he will get a second term, but I think it is very likely. Malema, in the last year and a half or so, had been starting to agitate for a change of the presidency of the ANC as a party. That is the decision to be taken by the party in next December, as you say, a year from now. And then round about April or May 2014, we will have our next general election. So what Malema was saying is, next year, 2012, we need to change the leadership of the party, and that would be followed in due course about 18 months later by a change of the national president. And the reason why Malema was pushing for that was that he and many of the young people in the country, many of the trade unionists, had become a bit disillusioned with Zuma's failure to make radical changes at a social and economic level. We still have very, very high unemployment, especially amongst the youth. Our land problems, people's access to land have not been sorted out. Our education system is in a bit of a mess. And all of this is causing young people in particular, and when I speak about young people in terms of the ANC, that's anybody under 35, causing them to become a bit hopeless and disillusioned. And so Malema had been starting this campaign to say, we need to replace Zuma. Now that he is out of the picture, that is a big weight taken off Zuma's shoulders. But there are still some very prominent and influential political forces at work that will still try to have Zuma replaced at the party conference next year. So I'd say his position is probably about 70% secure now. whereas before it was a 50-50 situation.
Malema has effectively been axed by the ANC for bringing the party into disrepute. How would you say, in general, have South Africans reacted to this news?
I think the reactions have been very varied. There was quite a large proportion of the population who disliked him intensely and believed that he was politically dangerous. And, of course, they're very happy that he has now been put out of active politics for possibly as much as 5 years. That's the length of time that he's been suspended by his party. But I think there was an equally large proportion of the population, particularly among young black people, who looked up to him as a leader and believed that he was speaking the truth in his many, many pronouncements. And I think that they are quite upset and disillusioned about his axing.
Malema says he will appeal the verdict, and he has vowed he will continue to go ahead in his political mission. How do you see this possibility?
Two different things there. The ANC as a party has its own internal processes for disciplining people, and once they've been disciplined, they may appeal to a particular tribunal. And if they fail in that appeal, they can then petition the party leadership. So there's a whole series of steps that he can take at a formal level to try to get this decision reversed or the punishment to be diminished. But over and above that, there's nothing to stop him as a private citizen traveling around the country and convening meetings, as long as he doesn't do so in the name of the party from which he's been suspended. He can still do it as a private individual. His supporters are still free to assist him, to give him a profile. The media will definitely report what he says because the media love him, even though they claim to dislike a lot of what he says. He sells newspapers and he makes the front pages. So I think that he has a political role to play, which he'll have to sort of carve out for himself outside of the party that he has belonged to for so long.
Malema obviously taps into ills of society to which people can relate. But what is his secret? I mean, he's being investigated for fraud and corruption. He lives an insultingly lavish lifestyle in a country where so many people are poor. I mean, where does his popularity stem from?
Well, there's no easy and, I think, simple answer to that question. It is a contradiction, and it's a contradiction that many of us fail to understand. His personal lifestyle, as you say, very lavish, unexplained by his fairly small salary as a party official. And remember, Malema held no public office. He wasn't a member of parliament or anything like that. He was a paid party worker and not a very high salaried position. So clearly he is getting money from somewhere else. There are allegations of corruption, although he has not ever been charged in court. The investigations are ongoing. Other people say that he has backers, he has sponsors who help to maintain his lifestyle. And they obviously are people who were hoping that if he one day rose to real prominence politically, became a cabinet minister or something like that, then they would be able to enjoy the payback. But apart from that, he's a very charismatic speaker. He has that ability to identify with the needs and the aspirations and the frustrations of whichever audience he's busy talking to. He is, as people say, very much in touch with the people on the ground. And he gives this impression, or he perhaps creates the illusion, of sharing their suffering, sharing their concern, and thus being able to speak on their behalf. And then he has been prepared to say things which other political leaders have been too shy or too cautious to talk about, such as nationalization of the mines, taking land from white people without compensation, and a few other very radical and, quite frankly, silly ideas like that, which have never been or were never going to become policy of the ANC, but which made people feel happy and made people feel like, here's somebody who really is going to do something drastic to help us out of our plight. Anyone with any brain, economically, politically, realized that his ideas could only make the situation worse in the long run. But if you're hungry, if you don't have a job, if you don't have hope of a job, if you are frustrated because you haven't got access to land or a house, then perhaps you don't think too far into the long term. And when some well-spoken, articulate politician stands up and makes these wild promises, perhaps you're inclined to want to follow him.
I have just come back from South Africa, and I got the feeling that a lot of people are not happy with Zuma. With Malema, let's say, out of the picture, it seems. Are there other candidates who are likely to rise in the near future?
Very difficult to say. The ANC traditionally does not have very open races for position. People don't announce their candidacy, as we're seeing, for example, with the American political parties now, where you have, how many is it, 7, 8, 9, 10 Republicans all wanting to be president and fighting with each other and having debates. It's not like that here. The ANC's tradition is that the succession is decided more or less by the 100 or so leading members of the party, the National Executive Committee. And everybody in the run-up to the conference that happens every 5 years, everybody pretends that they're not interested. If I can make the analogy, which I think is a fitting one under the circumstances, a little bit like a papal conclave. No cardinal would ever suggest that he's interested in the top job. And it's the same with the ANC. Nobody will say that they're interested. And then at the last minute, one or two names will emerge. We're not at that last minute yet. There is nobody who has said, I'm prepared to stand against Zuma in December 2012. And I don't think that we will find such a person emerging until very close to that date. And indeed, we might not find anyone. If Zuma is able to cement his position between now and a year from now, it's quite possible that he will receive a second term unopposed. And that will mean that he also gets a second term as national president in 2014. Whether that will happen, I don't know. But the present deputy, Kgalema Motlanthe, is favored by many, many people across the board. He's quite favored by the left wing as well as by business. He is an intellectual, a very calm man. But he lacks much personality, and I'm not sure how deep his backing is within the ANC itself. And apart from him, we can speculate about it. A number of cabinet ministers, a number of the provincial leaders of the ANC, every now and then someone puts a name forward or someone interviews such a leader in the newspaper, but then nothing happens further than that. So at the moment, I think that Zuma is in the pole position, and unless he does something very wrong between now and the end of next year, I think it's likely that he will retain his position.
You've been listening to Mike Pothier, Research Coordinator of the Parliamentary Office of the Southern Africans Bishop Conference. That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni, but we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.